Okay, thank you. So, just recap, recall that the main thing we did in these last two times was that we defined the Gaussian free field and we defined this notion of local set and made that pretty precise and proved some things about local sets. That, for example, the union of two local sets is also local. And given a local set, we know that the expected height off of the local set is harmonic. And we made sense of what it means to look at the infinitesimal neighborhood of the local set and condition on the heights, in some sense, on the local set, test the infinitesimal neighborhood. And given that, we just have the law of the conditional law of the Gaussian free field being given by a Gaussian free field in the complement of the local set. So then we also spent last time constructing our first really interesting examples of local sets, where we concocted this coupling of the Gaussian free field with SLE. And we made this coupling that worked for all values of kappa and argued that this actually gave a coupling between SLE and the Gaussian free field such that the SLE was local. And then we argued that in the specific case of kappa equals 4, at least, this path that you get is a function of the field, and gave an argument for that. And so for these arguments, the proofs are more or less what I gave. I didn't leave very much out. The description of the local set, the coupling, I described how to prove that you actually get the Gaussian free field at the end when you get this coupling, and gave a reasonable sketch of the argument that you, that this is unique. So today I'm going to talk about random geometries, and one way of interpreting some of these local sets for kappa is other than 4. So, as we mentioned before, given any function h, you can define a vector field that you get by just interpreting h as an angle. So you just take e to the I times h, and that gives you a unit vector for every point. And in this case, the function in question is, well, it's a linear function of y, so you can see that the direction of these angles only depends on y. And now you can ask, what are flow lines of these vector fields? You could kind of follow them along. In this case, you'll get something asymptotically getting closer to this straight line. You know, this straight line is sort of a stable flow line, meaning anything that's slightly off it will sort of converge to it. And here you have a parallel unstable flow line, meaning anything slightly off it will diverge away from it. So we have these flow lines, and and these are just, you know, solutions to some ODE. And it's natural to ask if these solutions are uniquely defined. And with mild regularity conditions, for example, the function being Lipschitz is enough, these paths are going to be well defined. And they're also reversible. If I, at least in these discrete, in these, for these Lipschitz functions, if I were to add the constant pi to h so that all of the arrows were now pointing the opposite direction, I could then follow these paths backwards. Here's an example where the function is x squared plus y squared. And here you see, if you look at a flow line, you're going to get kind of a spiral. You tend to, the stable flow lines, so this is kind of a stable, an attracting goalie sort of here, where flow lines tend to converge into a path like this that spirals down out. And if I were to rotate all these angles 180 degrees. Well, then if I follow the flow line backwards, it would spiral back in, but that would be kind of unstable. And the stable flow lines spiral outward. So, one fanciful way I sometimes describe this is that if you had a compass that gives you your direction, and you have a needle telling you your direction, and you have, on the other hand, an altimeter, the old-fashioned kind of altimeters that were analog. They have a needle, usually one that tells you your height modulo 10,000 feet, and one needle that gives you your height modulo 1,000 feet, and you just read it like a clock. So you look at, just look at the one that gives you your height modulo 10,000 feet, and so for every altitude, this is pointing in some direction. And if you hold these both in your hands and you turn in such a way that the two needles align, if you think about it a minute, what you'll see is that if you're doing this, that means that the direction you're facing is a linear function of your altitude. So I go up 500 feet, and now I would have to turn 180 degrees to keep the two needles aligned. So if you go hiking on a mountain and you carry this altimeter and compass in your hands and you follow, you always keep the two needles aligned and just keep walking, you're going to follow one of these altimeter compass lines. Now, this is one of the more important practical applications of my work, is modeling the trajectory taken by people who choose to hike in this way. What's that? You don't go hiking with me. Yes, well, with good reason. So, all right, so now, there was sort of some choice in how I chose this line, meaning I could have, when I took the altimeter in my hand, I could have rotated it, say 90 degrees, so that instead of starting out by walking this way, I start out by walking a different way. And all these different possible trajectories I would want to take correspond to basically adding a constant alpha to your height, h. And now I'm also going to talk about dividing h by a constant chi. That will come into play later. But so h plus chi now is the function. And so this alpha is sort of giving me my initial direction. And so for any alpha, I have a vector field whose flow lines, or a vector field given by the unit vectors corresponding to this. And now I can imagine I modify my sense of direction. I'm just going to say this direction, e to the 2 pi I alpha plus h over chi, I'm going to call that east if alpha is 0, north if alpha is 2.5, west if it's 0.5, south if it's 0.75, and all the things in between. So what does that mean? So I'm saying that if I go back to this picture, I'm going to now consider that all of these arrows point north. So I have a kind of modified geometry. Every single one of these arrows points north. And if I rotate each of these arrows 90 degrees, that's the direction east. So I'm going to view a trajectory, a flow line of this path, as being, well, it's a straight line in this appropriate altered geometry in which all of these lines point north. So, if h is, what's that? Oh, I'm sorry, east, yes, east. Oh, why did I make 0 east? Well, because I was thinking of the argument of the complex vector, right? It's east is 0. Okay. So, all right, so now if h is 0, if h is any constant, then the rays of this AC geometry will just be the normal rays in Euclidean geometry. So you'll just, they'll be straight lines. And more generally, like I said, if H is Lipschitz, then at least these paths are determined. Okay, so conformal maps of these geometries. Well, what you can see is if I were to take one domain and map it to another domain, so I'm mapping D to a D prime, and I take a conformal map. Well, conformal maps, they preserve angles locally, but if I take one of these vector fields and map it over here, well, all of the angles in this vector field might get rotated somewhat. And how are they rotated? Well, the amount they're rotated is by the argument of the derivative of the map from one to the other. So when I map one domain to the other, and I take the same h that I have on one domain and I pull it back to a function on the other, if I want to get the same vector field, if I want to get the conformal map of the same vector field to the flow lines over here, or the images of the flow lines over here, then in order to do that, I have to replace h with h plus this constant times the argument of the conformal map. And think about it. In particular, this applies that if h happens to be harmonic, then these rays are going to be locally the images under a conformal map of the rays in a Euclidean geometry. So if h is harmonic, then this map is essentially Euclidean, a Euclidean geometry, but conformally mapped. So it's warped, but still. For example, if I take a triangle, the sum of its angles add up to 180 degrees. And you can just see that by, if h is harmonic, then there's an analytic function whose imaginary part is h, and then locally at least, and then you could take g to be a map whose derivative is e to the h tilde, so then the log of that is just h tilde. And so there's a function like this, at least locally, and that maps you into a space where you just have Euclidean lines. So this is a geometry that, if the function is harmonic, it's just the ordinary Euclidean geometry. Now, what if H is not harmonic? Well, so H, I've been using the word random geometry. Some people wouldn't use that word for what I have because I don't really have a metric. Or they would at least qualify it and say this is a non-metric random geometry. Another way to think of what I've described is that it's actually an affine connection. So it actually gives you a way to parallel transport vectors. You know, as you move along, as you take a point and move it along, your tangent space is rotating by this field. And these paths, you could think of them as autoparallels of the random connection, of this connection. So you can actually interpret this AC geometry as a non-metric geometry. Okay, now I'm saying, let me say, so the first part I said this holonopy group consists entirely of dilations. So what do I mean by that? Okay, so in an ordinary world, say you take the surface of the Earth, there's a notion of parallel transport, which means just moving without rotation. And if I start on the equator and then I move 90 degrees around the equator, to imagine I slide without turning, and then I go up to the North Pole, and then I slide back down, what you can see is even though at no point on this time have I actually turned, the net effect after I've taken this trip is that I've been rotated 90 degrees. And another way to see that is that the sum of the angles of this triangle don't add up to 180 degrees, they add up to 180 plus this extra 90. And so that extra 90, the amount that I'm rotated when I do this rotation, is actually the integral of the curvature over this space. It's this nice fact in two dimensions. And it's one way of defining the curvature. You could take that as the definition, if you like. So the curvature is telling you locally when you draw small paths by how much does the angle fail to add up to 180 degrees divided by the area. And so, but in this case, what happens when I follow these paths? Well, what happens now is that, well, first of all, as I move along, my reference frame does rotate. So if I start facing north, then as I move along some trajectory in here in such a way that I'm always facing north, is what I would have to do if I were doing parallel transport without rotation. I'm always facing north. When I come back to the same place, I'll still be facing north. So this particular, the method of parallel transport this describes is such that there's no rotation in the holonomy group. I do parallel transport around a place. I don't get rotated. But on the other hand, if you look at pictures like, I guess you can see that, imagine if I had a small bug moving along this direction, you can see that it's sort of getting smaller and smaller. All the arrows are coming together. So you'd have to kind of get squashed and get smaller and smaller. And that the rate that you're getting smaller and smaller corresponds to the derivative of this function h in the orthogonal direction. And if you move around, you can actually do an integration by parts to show that the amount by which you shrink when you make one of these trajectories is equal to the integral of the Laplacian of h over that. So one way to interpret this is that if you have a Riemannian two-dimensional manifold and you take a trajectory around that, you're going to have real curvature, which means that if you view your tangent space as being a complex space, when you parallel transport around that space, parallel transport around a path that has the effect of rotating your tangent space, which is multiplying it by e to the I times the integral of the curvature. And in that case, the curvature is real. And if the curvature were imaginary, then multiplying by e to the I times this integral would give you, instead of multiplying by an imaginary number of modulo 0, you'd be multiplying by a real number, which is just a pure dilation. See, one way to think of this, if it helps, is that real curvature corresponds to the holonomy group consisting just of rotations in a Riemannian manifold, and imaginary curvature in a non-metric manifold corresponds to the holonomy group consisting entirely of dilations.
In the examples that you showed, were there any closed loops?
Closed loops?
Yeah, I thought you said
that. No, and in fact you can see that there can't be for this H. And the reason is, well, just think, you know, if H is smooth and you follow one of these paths, then if you were to form a closed loop, then as you moved around a loop, the net amount that you had turned, the sort of net winding that you had done in making that loop would have to be 2 pi. But if you think about it, what that means is that as you made that loop, your height, the net amount, your height increased was 2 pi. So when you came around, if you were at the same place, then you would have to also be 2 pi higher. And so that could only happen if you had a cliff there. If it would only happen if you were dealing with a wildly discontinuous object, like the Gaussian free field. But it's not going to happen here. This trajectory? Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Holonomy is still defined in terms of closed loops. So there are two issues here. One is there's an autoparallel, they call it, which is a flow line of this vector field. And another is something I haven't described in that much precision, but it's this notion of parallel transporting of parallel transport that says a connection, and that's defined for any closed loop. And if you want, you can just take what I described as the definition. Is when you move a little bit in some direction, what is happening to your tangent space? Well, it's rotating by just the amount that the direction is changing as you go that way, and it's getting squashed together or being stretched out by the derivative in the orthogonal direction. So you can take that as the definition of the connection. And then these are the autoparallels of that connection. So I apologize, maybe some people in the audience aren't familiar with these geometry words. I'm myself only marginally familiar with them. But things like, connection is just saying you have a tangent space. As you, for any path, you're going to get some rotation of that tangent, some linear map of that tangent space, which corresponds to translation without slipping, without rotation, and we're called parallel transport. And so the connection just tells you infinitesimally for every direction as you move a small amount in that direction, what is the infinitesimal change being made to this, to your tangent space. Okay. All right. So now what we're thinking about is geometries with purely imaginary curvature. Now, geometries with pure real curvature have been very thoroughly studied, Riemannian geometries, but surprisingly little bit has been done on geometries with purely imaginary curvature. But you can get them all in this way. You just take an H and define it, at least locally. And it's negative the Laplacian of H. Remember, before we thought of this as a charge density. So when H was the free field, we thought of this as a kind of Coulomb gas model. And so now minus the... So now what I'm saying is, well, what if you take a random geometry whose Laplacian is, or a random geometry whose curvature is an imaginary multiple of the Gaussian free field. Seems like a natural enough thing to do. And I mean, why is that natural? Well, I guess I'll leave that to you. So okay, so now we're asking, so is there a natural way to define these flow lines of e to the I h over chi, when chi is some constant, and h is the continuous Gaussian free field, with it, this imaginary curve, this curvature, is I times this Coulomb gas. Well, okay, so the answer is yes, using these couplings between SLE kappa and the Gaussian free field given earlier. And these flow lines are going to be local sets, and they'll be forms of SLE kappa, where kappa is between 0 and 4, and chi has this particular form. So we defined lambda earlier, and chi is this particular function of lambda. And there's a constant height gap between one side of the flow line of the other. And you can, so you recall before we had this constant height gap in the case of the, when we had level lines of the free field. And now we're going to have a constant height gap. And because now you can view heights as gate, as angles, it's natural to think of this height gap as being an angle gap. And you can ask, what does that angle correspond to? And that angle is kappa times pi over 4 minus kappa. Or you can say this is kappa over 2 times 4 minus kappa revolutions. Okay, so what am I talking about here? So last time we pretty much rigorously constructed these local sets that had the property that these are local sets of the Gaussian free field and conditioned on this local setup to time t, the expected height off of this set is given by a harmonic function, that is some value minus lambda on this side, lambda on this side, and all along this path it's minus lambda plus the winding. And what do I mean by winding? Well, the winding corresponds to the derivative of the conformal map when you map back. So I should stress that if this were a straight line going up, then, and I take the derivative to be zero along here, then the derivative up here when I map back is going to be 90 degrees, pi halves. So the height gap between either side of this straight line is not exactly 2 lambda. It's 2 lambda plus 1 half, I mean plus pi, plus 1 half revolution. And so I'm going to think of that as, so this height gap, I'll denote it by, let's say I have minus lambda prime on this side, lambda prime on this side. That's the height gap you would get if this were a straight line. And so it's natural to ask, what is the angle of this height gap? Because, so in this case, if I just take this straight line and look at the harmonic function off this straight line, what is the height gap going to correspond to? Well, that means if I, say, look at north going lines, I guess east going lines, whatever lines correspond to going this direction when the height is zero, then on one side I'll have arrows pointing inward, on the other side I'll have arrows pointing inward this way. So, and it turns out that these flow lines I get when cap is less than 4 are stable. So it means that the height gap is such that the angles are pointing in. So north on one side is pointing into the line, and north on the other side is pointing in this way. Okay. So if you like, this random geometry stuff is all interpretation of the things I actually constructed mathematically yesterday. So, here are some pictures, and some of you have seen these before, that I, now this is a north going line, and starting here and ending here. And so what do I mean by that? So, in this case, if you imagine I had a north going line going from infinity and coming all the way up to here, coming up to some point, and I have that constant height gap between the two that I described before, then if I take the Gaussian free field in the complement with these boundary conditions, and I get a flow line of that, well, it's going to continue up in some random trajectory. And if I stop this at some time, and I conformally map back to this half plane minus this slit again, then when I do that conformal map, I have to make an adjustment to the heights in order to keep the fields looking the same. And the adjustment to the heights I make is precisely adding this h sub t, which is the conditional expectation of the free field. And so that's what really gives you this, lets you see the conformal Markov property from this. It's one way to see, intuitive way to see that this sort of path is going to have to be an SLE. And then, so if I take this and now I were to conformally map myself to a finite domain like this triangle so that I can draw a picture, then I have to add some constant, I have to modify the boundary conditions, because I'm now taking this conformal map here, so I have to add a harmonic function to this. The harmonic function, the boundary condition, the values will correspond to the derivatives along these lines of the conformal map that maps you back to, say, the half plane, this model. And those derivatives are going to be constant along these lines. And you have to work out what the values are. But so you see here I have four different colors on these four lines corresponding to those values. So this really is taking this picture over here and mapping it into this diamond and then looking at what this path would be. So then I take an actual Gaussian free field and I start doing a discretized version of this altimeter compass walk and just see what happens. And that's the line I follow. That should correspond to kappa equals 0.7. Now, if you think about the altimeter compass picture, you can see that you had this parameter. So I said your compass was telling you your height modulo 1,000 feet. And if instead it told you your height modulo 1,000,000 feet, then that would change the amount of winding you do when you walk around on the face of the Earth. So if you're walking on this planet, that would mean you do more or less a straight line because you're not going to, on that scale, your altitude is not changing very much. But if you change it to 1,000 feet or to 5 feet, that's going to make you wind a whole lot. So if it were 1,000 feet, you know, if you start on the top of Mount Rainier and start walking, you're going to spiral down around about 10 times before you get to the bottom. And you can see that if you made it 1,000,000, if you made it, say, 1 foot or something, so you're spiraling around 10,000 times on the way down, then you're more or less tracing out level lines. And that's why kappa equals 4 arises as a limit of these models. So the high values of kappa correspond to very sensitive altimeters, or if you prefer, they correspond to you're taking large multiples of your Gaussian free field to use when you define these flow lines. So this is now the north going tree. Let me go back to that. So now what I've done here is I've just picked points spaced out in some random fashion. I took some grid here, point here, 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 here. And then I drew the line starting from those points, stopping when they hit the boundary. And what you see is now these paths, they kind of tend to flow, merge into each other, like tributaries of a river. And all of these paths eventually approach, hit this endpoint, but some of them merge into the boundary. And then if you continued them, they would follow the boundary and then hook up with this. And some of them, you know, just merge directly into this top point. Okay. And here is also kappa equal 0.7. Now I drew east and west going trees. And eventually I'm going to try to find continuum versions of all these objects. The key is they will just be local sets. That's the framework in which they live, and they're local sets coupled with the Gaussian free field. And here we constructed them starting at the boundary. And you might ask, how are we going to construct them when we're starting at a point in the interior? And it's a little bit tricky, but you can always sort of give yourself a little start, draw a little slit, kind of force it in there, and then you know how to extend that slit. And if you let the slit get small, you end up getting a coupling with the field. And the trick is then showing that these things are unique functions of the free field. So here, this corresponds to kappa equals 2, slightly windier picture, and slightly windier looking tree, north going line tree. And this corresponds to kappa equals 3.5. And in this case, when we draw the north going tree, we notice some funny things happening. A lot of these paths are now actually, I mean, it's hard to even make sense about looking at this, but the reason is a lot of these paths actually go around and hit themselves and sort of form loops. So I mentioned earlier, if you're on a function with cliffs, a really discontinuous function, then occasionally you may actually form a loop and come back to the same place. Just there's a ledge and you're kind of at a lower point along the ledge. And the way we define these level lines, well, there were sort of implicitly ledges all along the line. And so now it kind of makes sense that sometimes the flow lines will come back and hit themselves. And that turns out to happen whenever the gap between the gap in the heights is bigger than the amount that you, when you go around, when you make a loop, if these height gaps overlap, then you're going to be able to intersect. So I guess the important thing, okay, so I want to recall how I actually constructed these before. So recall from last time we had this important martingale of SLE, which was, it was this H sub T of Z, which was this linear combination of this argument of F sub T and the argument of F sub T prime. And the argument of F sub T corresponds to the angle, and that sort of describes how big you should make lambda. This constant, and this arg of F sub T prime corresponds to the winding number. And that corresponds to what multiple of the free field you should use to define your flow lines. And so this gives you a relationship between lambda and chi. They have to be related. And so there's some flexibility in how you choose lambda and chi. But if I define chi in terms of, if I define my height gap not in terms of the size of the field, but in terms of the, try to make it an angle, then as an angle, it's determined. I have no flexibility. Okay. And so this theorem, we more or less proved last time, is that in these couplings of the free field and the SLE that we described, this random set is a local set. In fact, for any stopping time, this set gamma image of 0 to t is also local. Now, what I didn't show you last time at all was that these local sets are deterministic functions of H. I only gave an argument for that in the case kappa is equal to 4. So I mentioned this earlier, this in radians we have this gap, kappa over 2, 4 minus kappa revolutions. And now, here's some things we can derive from known facts about SLE kappa rho processes. So first, I want to draw some pictures. So before, you know, we had these heights minus lambda, lambda. And it was natural, and so we only kind of define these level lines with these special boundary conditions. But it's very natural to ask, what if instead of minus lambda and lambda on the side, what if you started with some other boundary conditions? And one of the simplest cases is to say, let's say you have piecewise constant boundary conditions. So here I have some, you know, I have some value A and B and C. I put some other constants on parts of this, and then I try to draw the path. And if you like, I'll still have it be minus lambda and lambda in the neighborhood of this point, at least when I start out. So it's clear it's growing like an SLE, and you can use those, you can use this almost independence rules and some things to say that how this is growing is absolutely continuous with respect to if you had regular boundary conditions, at least up until the first point you hit the boundary. But you have to work out what the drift term is, and it turns out that this path, I mean, you just write down that this H sub T has to be a martingale, and now this H sub T is, well, it's this winding number plus, and it's not just the harmonic extension of minus lambda and lambda, it's the harmonic function of minus lambda and then whatever values I have here on these intervals. And if I want that to be a martingale at a point, that forces me to make this path then SLE kappa rho, or rho 1, rho 2, rho 3, where the force points, the SLE kappa rho, are these gaps, and the values of rho are proportional to the size of the gaps. And, of course, there's nothing stopping you from having, instead of just gaps, of having, say, some continuous function, some other function here that's not piecewise constant. And that just corresponds to taking SLE kappa rho with, instead of having a finite set of points that are force points, you have sort of a continuous distribution of force points. Remember, the sort of force that you have here is kind of equal to, if you think of these as charges, sort of equal to the amount of force you get here from all of those charges. And so now, if you have a continuum system of charges, well, you can still compute the force on this point from those. Okay. So I should mention, of course, this idea of these charges, you know, in pictures somewhat like this, is very related to things that Cardi and other physicists, Renard Duplantier, lots of others have done. So these pictures very related to this have been studied in the Coulomb gas method of exploring these models for a long time, but they're not, as far as I can tell, they're not the same. They're related, but exactly how they're related is a bit of a puzzle, and why they give the same answers is a bit of a puzzle. Because this other perspective is, well, I won't go into it, but it certainly it doesn't involve constructing flow lines of the free field in the way that I'm doing now. Okay, so now just using these facts we know about SLE kappa rho processes, we can now start to do some things. For example, we could start growing SLEs at different points. And so this now gives us a very natural way to grow SLEs from different points. You just take the same field and you take flow lines, perhaps starting at different points, perhaps at different angles of this same field, and you start drawing them all. And one way to prove that these things commute, so this is all, you know, stuff that Julian has done, but one way to see that these things commute is to say that they are all local sets of the Gaussian free field, and that they're all functions of the Gaussian free field. And then you can, and once you know that, you can just first choose the field, and then it doesn't matter the order in which you draw these things, because they're all determined by the field. Now, one thing you can see is that you start drawing these things, you can ask, okay, when will it be the case that one of these paths will hit one of the other paths? One of these paths will hit the boundary. And so this can all be worked out from known facts about SLE kappa rhos when they hit the boundary. So if you just have an SLE kappa rho, there's some Bessel process describing when you conformally map back the difference between the image of the tip and the image of, so I have my path and look at the image of the tip and the image of one side, and if this is my only force point right here, then when I conformally map back, you can, and look at the distance between those two points, it's just going to be a Bessel process. And, you know, when are they going to hit each other? Well, you know, it's easy to work out. And this is, you know, it's done in papers by Vendelin and Vendelin, Lawler, and Schramm. So you work out exactly when these paths hit the boundary, and then when I start drawing these paths from different points, I now know when is it going to be the case that one of these paths will hit the other. And so Now, you know, I'm not going to work out all the computations, but I'll summarize some of what we get when we do this. One thing you see is that if I take these two different rays of different alpha values, then they can hit each other and then cross only if the angles are such that the corresponding Euclidean lines would cross. If I take something going east, something going north, and they hit, they can cross. But if I take something going east and something going southeast and start them at this point, then they can't cross each other. And if they do that and they only cross at one point, so they cross at exactly one point. Now, two vertical paths angled away from each other, one's going south, one's going east, one's going southeast, they can actually hit each other, bounce off one another, but not cross. And that can only happen if the angle difference between them is less than the height gap, less than this angle gap between the two sides. And again, you work that out just by using known facts about SLE kappa rho. So there's no hard math involved. You know, I've given you a rigorous way to draw these paths, and now you just have to ask, you know, are they going to hit each other? So there's no hard math in working this out. And get it directly from the Gaussian free field? And so the only way I know how to prove these things is to first convert to SLE and then use facts about SLE kappa rho. I don't know how to see directly from the geometry of the Gaussian free field that these paths can't cross. Yes? Well, right, so that's intuition. But, you know, when I actually define these objects, you know, there's no function. I mean, the field is not a function. So the only honest definition I have of these things is, well, they're local sets. And my only honest way to construct these local sets is to produce this coupling between SLE and the Gaussian free field explicitly, like I did yesterday, and then to argue that it's a local set and that it's determined by the free field. So there is some information you can get about the behavior of SLE using things about the Gaussian free field, but these particular things, you know, when they hit, I only know how to see that by converting back to the SLE formulation. So this height gap, so angled away from each other, they can still cross if this height gap is not, if the angle gap is not too large. But for big enough values of kappa, the angle gap can be quite large. In fact, the angle gap can be bigger than 2 pi. And so this, so so if I ask, when can it be the case that I can have a flow line that can actually go around and come and bounce off itself? Well, if this happened, then as I've gone around, the height has changed by 2 pi in angle. So the angle gap between this and this is now 2 pi. They're sort of angled away from each other at angle 2 pi. And if you work it out, you see that a path can complete k revolutions and hit itself only if kappa is bigger than 4k over k plus 1. Okay, so When I say half revolution, what I mean by that is you could also, at this point, you can take the dual, you can add pi to all your directions and take the lines that go the opposite direction. And so if I have a north-going tree, you kind of think the south-going tree should be dual to that. North and south-going lines don't intersect. And it actually is a property that we can show. So the north-going lines and the south-going lines each form trees, and if you draw the south-going line, it's going to so I'll say what happens. For when kappa is less than 2, if I draw one line, say, let's say I get a west and an east-going line starting at a point, then, you know, at any generic point, when I draw these lines, they won't intersect themselves or each other. When I take kappa equals 8/3, I have a critical point where suddenly this path starts intersecting the dual line. So that's sort of an angle of half of a revolution. And so you have half a revolution. And then you can ask, so if this is a flow line, and this is the dual, you know, maybe the dual comes back around and hits here. Maybe this comes around and hits here again, and you can ask, okay, I draw the line in the dual starting at a point. How many of these things can I have meeting at the same place? Well, there are critical points for when that happens, and they correspond to this 4 kappa divided by kappa plus 1 values, which I understand Cardi explained the significance of. Or this is a different set of numbers? These minimal models. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is something, you know, why the minimal models, as they're understood in physics, should be the points of criticality for this kind of behavior is far from clear to me, but I know that these values are special for this reason. Okay, so now we want to talk about duality. So, okay, so I want to say that for kappa is less than 4, so if you recall when you had the uniform spanning tree, there was this notion of taking the outer boundary of the uniform spanning tree and arguing that uniform spanning tree is this tree made up of SLE2s and the outer boundary is an SLE8. So I'm going to want to argue something similar for these other trees. That if so that's for kappa equals 2, but if you take the tree of flow lines corresponding to kappa equals 0.7, then there should in some sense exist a boundary of that tree, and that boundary should correspond to SLE 16 over kappa. So I want to go back to this picture I had. When I had the east and west going trees all merging into the boundary. So in this case, what I've done is I've taken, you have an east going path here and a west going path here, and the heights are given by, or what the height should be on the right side of an east-going path and what the height should be here on the left side of a west-going path. And then if I start taking other points here and I draw the flow line here, they will merge in. I get a tree of things merging into this. And there's a dual tree. At each point I can draw, I get something merging into into this other side. Okay, so so what do I get here? So if I do this for every point, I'm going to end up having an infinite tree, and there's an ordering of points. If I take two different, say, two rational points with rational coordinates, and then I can pick a point here, and I draw the west going line and I draw the east going line, and I say this point comes before that one if this point, when I draw these two lines, is disconnected from infinity. So, you know, I draw these two lines, it's clear that if I were doing the boundary of this tree, I would have to hit this point before that point, because, you know, I'm going to trace, if this is the dual, then I'm going to trace the boundary of everything contained inside this region before I exit here. So if you like, you can forget about trying to think of a boundary of a tree and just think about this ordering I've defined on rational points. One point is before the other if when you draw these two paths, which at least when capital is small, they don't intersect each other. They're nice paths. If this one comes before that one. So that gives us an ordering of points. And now, what's that? It's an actual ordering, and the reason you can see that is you're just using the fact that if you take a point, you know, the trees have to merge into the existing trees. You can't have, I mean, I guess that's how you make the ordering, even the partial ordering well-defined, is you can't have a path that goes and ducks down under. I mean, I guess it would be. And you also need that for, you know, for rational points, almost surely, say I take my rational points and then I can start these paths that may be some dense set of points, another dense set of points. I draw the path corresponding to those. And almost surely no rational points are hit by these paths. So you can, you know, each of these paths for a given point almost surely does not hit it. So I take the path started at the countable collection of points, draw them, and, you know, almost surely there's no rational point on one of these paths, so it's well defined when one is before the other. So this gives us a total ordering of the points. And to show us a total ordering, you just have to show for any two points, you know, there's going to be some tree that's going to separate the two. But it's not so hard to do. Okay. So we have this ordering, and you can ask, all right, you know, let's ask for the first, so we can now grow these sets according to this ordering. It gives us a way of growing these sets. You look at a point and look at everything before that. That gives you a hole. And I can look at this set of holes, and if I parametrize it by capacity, I have a growing set of holes. And I just want to argue that these holes are local sets. The hole stopped at time t is a local set. And if you know that, then you know, conditioned on this set, you know what the expected height has to be off of the field. So you know that this certain h sub t is going to be a martingale at points off of the field. And from that you can show that this has to be SLE. You get this conformal Markov property. And then you can work out exactly which SLE it is. It's the 16 over kappa. So, you know, the most subtle part of this argument that I have sketched is proving that these paths actually are functions of the free field. So, you know, you can, it's kind of not that hard to construct couplings starting at interior points, but you want them to be actual functions of the field. And that becomes, a little bit trickier when you have kappa big enough so that these paths are now hitting themselves. You still want to say, even though it's, you know, even by the time you get out an infinitesimal, by the time you get epsilon away from zero, your path is already wound around and hit itself infinitely many times. You still want it to be uniquely determined. And I'll just sort of sketch before ending, not that actual argument, but the argument for why at least the path is unique in the case that it starts at the boundary. And we have these minus lambda, lambda boundary conditions. So the reason, the way you actually see that is you first, you draw this path, one of these paths, that's a local set, and then at some point along this path, you draw a path angled 180 degrees this way from it. And that gives you a path that's not going to hit this, but it might, I mean, it might hit these sides, but it's not going to hit this out here. And then you argue just with these intersection rules that, okay, given this, if I had a different path that somehow managed to break away from this one, but it was still, you know, once it broke away, this was, it still had the right boundary conditions, minus lambda plus winding, lambda plus winding over here, that path could not ever hit this blue line. So given what the expected heights are, given this here, knowing that this has to be, you know, a kind of absolutely continuous with respect to an SLE kappa rho with these certain force points, you know that this simply cannot hit this part here. This has to merge. So it would, if it can't hit there, well, what can it do? We know it can't hit here, so, I mean, it would have to merge in somewhere under here. But, you know, I could have started drawing this blue path earlier. I could have picked any point to start drawing it. And you see that once this gets off, this path, you know, I could just take the first point this gets off and then take something very close to that and draw this blue path. You can see there's no place this can merge back in. And so, you know, if you had a distinct one, it would have to lie entirely to one side of your existing path. And, you know, and it would have to, so you have one, once it breaks away, it can never remerge. And then, you know, you just have to say, you look at infinity, you know, you draw one of these paths, and then you look at this blue line towards infinity. I mean, that's very distorted. And it's kind of clear that if you were drawing a second path on the side of this, one of these, it would be mutually singular with respect to an SLE when you get to infinity. I mean, it's very different. You've got this force coming from this extra path. So, well, that's the idea of the argument. So I think I'll stop here.